And open our minds and our hearts to Ronnie G from San Diego.
Oh man. Ocean City, Maryland. Marvelous, darling. My name's Ron, and I'm a grateful recovering addict. And I've been losing my voice for like 3 months, so I'm hoping tonight that I can get through this with a voice. I keep getting raspy, so. Oh, man. It's a lot of you people out there tonight. Man, can you hear me all right? Yeah? Well, the first thing I want to do is I would like to thank the convention committee, the Chesapeake Potomac region and the Central Maryland convention committee that put this together. I know a lot of work went into it. I was on the registration committee. I ran registration in San Diego for 5 years in a row, and it's a year-round job. And once again, I think we should give them a big round of applause. Thank you. Did I just turn around and let you see my bald spot? Man, I'm losing it already. Jeez. You know, last night I'm watching this speaker here, and I'm looking at the camera in the front. I'm going, oh, that's pretty neat, you know, the Jumbotron thing over here. And then I'm looking, they got a side camera, and I'm like, oh, no, this ain't gonna, no. I got this turkey gobbler that keeps shaking around, you know. I'm thinking, this ain't gonna look good, but... My nephew loves playing with this thing, you know. Oh man, I am nervous. I do this from time to time, and it seems like I still get nervous. And my wife, she's kind of cute. She always says, "Honey, you're not nervous. You're excited." So, like, I'm extremely excited right now, you know. My armpits are sweating. My hands are cold and clammy. You know, I'm vibrating from the inside out. You know, remember all the money we spent trying to feel that way, you know. And the convention committee helped me to do that, huh? Thanks a lot. Anyhow. You know, the first thing I'd like to do is I would also like to acknowledge all the people that are in their first year of clean time. Would you stand up and let us welcome you to Narcotics Anonymous? Yeah. Woo. Wow. All right. Welcome. Welcome to a spiritual program of recovery that can help change your life. You know, our hope as a fellowship for you are that you will keep coming back here no matter what. Whether you're clean, whether you're not clean, whether you have a job, whether you don't have a job, whether you're homeless, whether you have a home, keep coming back. And we hope that you'll keep coming back long enough to find somebody you can trust, and we usually call them a sponsor. And you'll allow that person to take you through the 12 steps and have a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps, which will bring you into relationship with a higher power, and it will give you freedom from active addiction. That's our hope for you. You know, you may not feel this way right now, but you are the lifeblood of Narcotics Anonymous. We can't keep what we have. unless we give it away to you. So please keep coming back. Please keep coming back. You know, I am an extremely blessed, grateful, and very fortunate drug addict. Through the program of Narcotics Anonymous and a relationship with a higher power, I have been clean and recovering in the program since November 25th, 1982. And that's 1982 BC, before crack. Yeah. Yeah, they didn't have crack in 1982. At least I didn't know about it, okay? You know, we hear all these heavy-duty stories in our meetings, you know? Like, you hear these guys talk about, well, you know, I started shooting heroin when I was 16 years old, and I was in and out of the penitentiary for 40 years, and I finally made it to NA, and I'm 62 years old, and I got a year clean. And you go, whoa, man, that's like some story, right? And then there's these other people that you hear, you know? You hear something like, well, I was a professor at Georgetown University, and in January, one of my students turned me on to crack, and 4 months later, I was homeless and pushing a shopping cart in downtown Washington, D.C., you know? Oh. We should have a, in our new basic text that's coming out, we should have a chapter called Crack, the Quick Surrender. Right? Man. I mean, I shot cocaine, but I heard that stuff's bad news. Anyhow. Okay, I'm a little less nervous now. Okay. What I'd like to share with you this evening is how this addict got to Narcotics Anonymous and what my life has been like since I've been here. You know, I live in San Diego, California, but I grew up in New Jersey. And New Jersey's in the house tonight. I know that because I have friends from New Jersey that came up to spend time with me this weekend, and I really appreciate that. And also, I was told to say this, Franny, Philly's in the house. All right. They made me do it. Anyhow, I grew up as a kid in New Jersey in the 60s. And the Vietnam War was going on. And I graduated high school in June of 1967. And a year later, I had hair down on my waist and a big Fu Manchu mustache. And I was walking around with an Eisenhower jacket with an upside-down American flag on the back. And everybody was getting high. And we had this new camaraderie. We had this new way of living. We had this new sense of freedom that we thought we were getting through drug use. And none of us had an idea, any clue, what bondage that was going to bring. And at the age of 20, 21 years old, I found myself standing in methadone lines. Trying to get there before work, you know, taking my juice so that I could get some type of manageability over my life again. And my whole life became obsessed with the getting and the using and the finding ways and means to get more of that. And it started to fall apart. And in 1977, I got probably what I considered at the time one of the biggest breaks of my life. I had just gotten a 5-year suspended sentence to Rahway State Prison in New Jersey, and I petitioned my PO, because they put me on formal probation. In 1977, what that meant is you had to urinate once a week, and once you dropped the dirty, you went and did a nickel. So it was like their way of getting a lot of money up front and then getting you later. And my PO, he was a good guy, you know, and I told him, I said, you know, I'm not going to make it here. And I have an aunt and uncle that lives in La Mesa, California, that are willing for me to live with them. Can you transfer me? And he petitioned the judge, and in 1977 of October, I traveled cross-country with everything I owned in my little Datsun B210 hatchback. Yeah. And driving across the country, I figured, you know, this is incredible. I'm going to California. It's where it's sunny and the girls wear bikinis and they probably don't even use heroin out there, you know, and everything's going to be different. I'm getting away from the Lower East Side of New York, Eldridge Street, Hell's Kitchen, Harlem, all my friends in New Jersey. I'm going to California and everything's going to be different. And here I move 3,000 miles. I move in with my aunt and uncle. I live on a mountain. They're very wealthy. You can see Mexico. You can see the ocean. Everything is different except me. And in 3 months' time, I'm sitting sharing a cooker with a guy named Bosco. And I'm looking at him, and it's hot, and he's got no shirt on, and he's got this tattoo of a Mexican wearing a sombrero pointing a shotgun at me. And I'm like getting nervous while I'm fixing, you know, and a big sign, Logan Heights, gang affiliation. And I'm thinking, what happened? Everything was going to be different. Remember those days when we told ourselves that if we just got the right woman or the right man, it was going to be okay. You know, or if we just moved to the right place, had the right job, made the right amount of money, everything was going to be okay. Well, here it was 3,000 miles away, not knowing anybody, and it wasn't okay again. And it started the spiral of addiction. And you know, we don't really care, newcomers, what you do, what drug you use, who your connections were, what you've done in the past, how much or how little you have. What we care as a fellowship is if you have a problem and you're willing to let us help you. So once again, please keep coming back. This program works. I started going to NA, I was on methadone again, something I swore I would never do. And once again, I'm on methadone and I'm going to these meetings. It's 1981 in San Diego. There's 14 meetings or 12 meetings a week in the county of San Diego. The fellowship at most is about 40 to 50 people strong in the whole county of San Diego. By the way, now in San Diego County, there's over 500 meetings a week. God has blessed the addict in San Diego, just like he's blessed the addict in Maryland. So I was going to these meetings, man, and you know what? My disease was looking for all the differences. You know, I'd hear you guys share, and I'm thinking, how are these people going to help me, man? I got a serious heroin problem. How are we going to sit around and talk about things and get better? And I struggled, and I was in and out for like a year and a half in treatment centers, out of treatment centers, recovery houses, I really wanted to be clean, but the disease was on me. You know, it was saying those little things to me, newcomer, that you're going to hear in your ear. Those little things like, come on, man, just one more. You know, come on, man, you're not going to lose your job this time, just one more. Oh, come on now, you know, you're not gonna lose your kids, your old lady, your old man. Just one more. You know, you can do it on the weekends. Just the weekends. Okay, you're not gonna do that. You can just drink like normal people, you know. The last time I tried to drink like a normal person, 4 days later I was shooting heroin again. It talks to us. You know, our literature says that the concepts of the disease or the attributes of the disease are based in obsession and compulsion. But what I've learned 25 years later of living this program and living these steps and staying connected to the process, that it's also a disease of isolation, separation, and illusion. You know, our basic text tells us that we are the masters of self-deception. Nobody lies to Ron like Ron. And I kept believing the lie. It would talk to me and I'd get 30 days clean and then I'd, one more time, just one more time. And the last time after 2 years of this, I had 90 days clean. And a friend of mine just got out of prison. And I wanted to take him to an NA meeting. And so I was picking Bobby up, taking him to meetings. And one night I went to pick Bobby up and he was tied off. And the first thing out of my mouth is, where's mine? And that sent me into a relapse that I couldn't get back to NA. You know, we say that the door swings both ways, and it does. But I couldn't get back in. The door was stuck. I remember going to meetings and fixing on the way to the meeting and crying in the meeting and just begging God, please let somebody say something that's going to help me. Please, God, I don't want to live like this anymore. Please help me. And the miracle happened for me in the fall of 1982. There was four of us at my house. We were shooting dope. It was me, Debbie, Paul, and Bobby. Bobby is doing life in prison on a third strike. Debbie died of endocarditis 7 years ago. And Paul just celebrated 5 years clean, and I'm his sponsor. We were all shooting dope, and everybody went home, and I went to go to bed, and I woke up on fire. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had this pain going down my arm and my chest, and I was burning up with fever, so I thought I got the flu. So I get out of bed, have a couple of shots of gin, go back to bed thinking it'll help me sleep. An hour later, I woke up, and I knew I was dying. I was shaking. I was on fire. I had pain. You know, like when you have a toothache, and every time your heart beats, your jaw hurts. Well, this was going down my left arm and my left side, and I called 911, and the paramedics came and got me. And they were driving me to the emergency room, and I remember them trying to put oxygen on me, and it was like throwing gasoline on a fire. Every time they did it, the pain got escalated 10 times. And we're fighting in the ambulance, and they finally get me to this hospital, and I'm admitted, and they're doing all these tests on me, and they finally find out that I shot a staph infection into my heart. And it's like cotton fever to the 20th degree. I've got septicemia of the blood system. I've got 105 fever. I've got emboli that have lodged in my right lung. I've got pneumonia. My kidneys are failed. I've got hepatitis C. And in 1982, they didn't even know what hepatitis C was. They called it non-A, non-B. And my two top ribs were being eaten away from a thing called osteomyelitis. Staph is a nasty, nasty infection. I mean, it's nasty if you get it outside of your body. But if you get it inside your body, it's fatal. And so I'm on these machines. They got me on life support machines. I'm in this hospital. Every so often I'm waking up. They're hitting me with Demerol. They're hitting me with Visceral. And after a couple of weeks, I wake up. And the doctors say, you're a very sick man. We want to do some other tests on you. We think you've got endocarditis. You've got this blood infection. You're going to be on these machines for 2 months. Do you understand how sick you are? Yes, I understand, you know. And meanwhile, I've got $1,700 in cash with me in this hospital. And the doctor explains to me that if I ever put a needle in my arm again, I'm going to blow up my heart. So I better take this 2 months that I'm going to be on machines and think about what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And as soon as that doctor walked out of that room, the insanity started. You know the insanity in our second step? You know the justification and the rationalization of the next one? Well, Ron, you're dying. You're hooked up to all these machines. Yeah, but there's nurses out there. You know, I got this little button here. If something goes wrong, you know, I need some relief. You know, I think of insanity like this addict and this normal person, and they want to get on the other side of this brick wall. And the normal person says, well, let's walk down a quarter of a mile around the edge of the wall, and we can get over there. And the addict goes, no, that's too long. No, what we're going to do is we're going to hold hands. You know, we can talk anybody into anything, right? We're gonna run into this wall. We're going to hit it really hard, and we're going to bust through the wall and save ourselves that long walk. So the normal guy goes, oh, okay. You know, and the addict grabs his hand and starts running towards the wall. Boom! They hit the wall. They fall down. Their noses are broken. They're bleeding from the face, man. The normal guy says, I don't believe we did that. He dusts himself off. He looks at the addict and says, you're out of your mind, man. You're crazy. I'll never do that again. You're on your own. And he walks away. And the addict looks at the wall and says, you know, maybe if we hit it this way, you know, it won't hurt as bad. Isn't that the insanity? Isn't that what we all suffered from over and over and over? Look at us tonight. We're clean. We're in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. We're celebrating our lives. The insanity was on me, man, and I called Bobby up at home, and I knew he was dope sick and wanted to get well, and I had $1,700. I said, Bobby, bring me a couple of balloons of heroin and an outfit. I need to get well, and it was on. And every day Bobby is coming up. Every morning I'm calling him what to bring me. They're hitting me with Demerol every 3 hours. They're hitting me with Visceral. I got all these NA people coming up, visiting me. You know, the word in the meetings are, oh, Ronnie G's dying. You better go see him before he dies. Okay, you know, so all you NA troopers are coming up there. And, oh, Ron, you better pray for the willingness to do whatever it takes to get clean. And I'm like, yeah, okay, nice. Can you leave now? You know, I'm expecting somebody, you know. And people in, people out, you know. Bobby would call from the lobby, hey, and those NA people up there, and they'd say, hold on, 5 minutes, I'll get rid of the last one, you know. Every day, 2 balloons a day, you know, every day thinking, is this going to blow my heart out? No, 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 if something happens, I'll hit the button, they'll come in, ba-boom, hit you with those things, you know. It's going to be okay, it's going to be all right, you know. And then one day, the door opens up, and my mother and sister come walking in from New Jersey. I'm like, Ma, what are you doing here? Well, we drove 3,000 miles because the doctor said you may not survive this. And the first thing, you'd think I'd be happy to see them, right? And the first thing I'm thinking is, how the hell am I going to use now? My mother's here. My sister Diane's here. Phone rings. I'm in the bed. I got all the machines hooked up. It's Bobby. Hey, anybody, any of those NA people up there? No, no. But my mother's here. Your mother? I said, yeah. My mother's looking at me like, who the heck are you talking to? You're dying. I said, oh, it's NA person. Bobby said, you got 5 minutes to get down here and get these balloons or I'm leaving. Remember the mind. Remember what this thing did to us. Remember that uncontrollable urge that no matter what the consequences were, you know, we had to have it. You know, in another fellowship, they talk about insanity as being doing the same thing over again and expecting different results. And in our fellowship, we know that insanity is doing the same thing over again, knowing exactly what's going to happen. That's insanity. And I'm pulling the IV out of my arm, and I'm taking the breathing apparatus off me, and I'm taking the heart monitor off, and I'm starting to get out of bed, and my mother's going, where are you going? I said, well, I got to get my meds, Ma. They forgot my meds. I'll be right back, Ma. And I got this little gray smock with my ass hanging out the back, you know? And I'm got to get downstairs. And so I sneak past the nurse's station. I'm up on the 8th floor. And I get on the elevator, and I'm going down, and the only thing I can think of is one more. Come on, get down there, one more. It's going to be okay. Once you get it in, one more, one more, one more. And I get down and the elevator door opens up and I look like Don King because I haven't showered in like 3 weeks. You know, my hair is matted, it's sticking up, you know. And this poor old lady gets on the elevator looking at me terrified. I go, hi ma'am, how are you? Nice to see you, you know. I get out of the elevator, there's Bobby nodding out. Bobby, give it up. He gives me a couple balloons, gives me the outfit and a spoon. I got no pockets, so I put the balloons in my mouth. I put the outfit under my arm, get back on the elevator. 8th floor, I'm going up. I can't wait, I can't wait, I can't wait. Door opens up, there's my mom, there's my sister, there's the nurses. They're like cackling hens. Where'd you go? What are you doing? Where'd you go? I gotta get to the room. Gotta get to the room. Gotta get to the room. I get to the room. They're all yelling at me. I go into the bathroom. I lock the door. Boom, boom, boom. Open the door. Open the door. I'll be right out. I'll be right out. I look around. I got the outfit. I got the balloons. I got the outfit. I go, oh no, where's the sink? There's no sink. I look at the toilet, what the hell? You know, I'm gonna cook it. I'm gonna sterilize it. Yeah, I know I got a heart infection, my bones are being eaten away, my lungs are shot out, I got 105 fever, but I'm gonna sterilize it. Remember the insanity that went on in our minds over and over and over. And nobody ever thought we'd get clean. Look at us tonight. Look at us. Thank you, NA. So in this hospital, it was madness. And one morning I woke up like every morning and I called Bobby up and I broke down. For the first time in my life, I looked at myself for what I really was, not what I wish I was. And I saw that everything I tried to do in life to bring me happiness and security and love and friendship was killing me. My best thinking was killing me, and I couldn't stop. And I had like a nervous breakdown, kind of like tonight in the beginning of this meeting, you know, when I looked out and saw all you guys. I said, God, please help me. And I told the nurses what I had been doing. And they told the doctors. And I was able to kick in that two-month period in that hospital. And the day I left that hospital, they drove me to a recovery house in Pasadena. And I spent the next 7 months of my life living with 65 other recovering drug addicts. Yeah. And I'll never forget walking up to that house, and all these addicts were out in the foyer and out on the lawn, and they were raking leaves that weren't even there. And they had little signs around their necks. And they saw me and they go, "Welcome, keep coming back." And I'm like, "Oh, my life is over, man. I don't believe this." And I lived with 65 other recovering addicts, and our Narcotics Anonymous basic text just came out. And finally, we had our own literature. We didn't have to steal it or read it from anybody else anymore. And I started to fill my spirit. I got a sponsor. I started taking our 12 steps. I worked up to my 8th step by my 7th month clean. And they said, "You know what? You've done well here. We want you to go back to San Diego." And you know, I was scared to death to go back there, because when I was using an NA, I had stole money from groups. I had ripped off members of Narcotics Anonymous because I was desperate. And I was afraid I wasn't going to be accepted back. And I asked this guy I worked for, Matt Siegel, who had like 30-something years clean at the time. I said, "Matt, I'm terrified. What do I do?" And he looked at me and he said something that is still pertinent today and I will never, I hope, never forget. He said, "Ronnie, as long as you put your recovery your number one priority, the rest of your life will take care of itself, whether you like it or not. And if you start putting the rest of your life before your recovery, you're going to suffer the pain of addiction." And in 25 years clean, I have suffered the pain of addiction. When I was 2 years clean, I got into what we call an addictive relationship. Oh, you know what I mean. I heard the girls laughing. You know about him or the fellas. You know about her. You know, when your eyes open up in the morning and the first thing you think about is her or him, and the last thing you think about before you go to bed at night is her or him. You know, we've got a new higher power and we have totally surrendered. And in a year and a half time, I lost about 25 pounds. I had rashes on my back. We had broken up 9 times. You know, and the illusion was just like drugs. Well, if we move away somewhere, it'll work. Or if we just got different sponsors, it would work. Or if nobody knew who we were, or we both went to therapy, it would work. And it didn't work. And it almost killed me. But I survived it. And when I was about 3.5 years clean, I had to have all my teeth pulled out. Because when I was 26, they capped them all from drug use. And I kept shooting dope. So everything started rotting away underneath the caps. So when I was 3 years clean, I met a guy in the rooms of NA who was willing to take payments, because no dentist wanted to take payments. They wanted the whole thing up front. And Dr. John, who I met in the rooms of NA, was a dentist. He said, "Ron, come see me, man. But I got to tell you, I'm not going to knock you out." I said, "What?" He said, "No, I've heard your story. But I'm going to numb you up from the top of your head to the bottom of your chin. You're not going to feel nothing." Oh, okay. And I made a decision to turn my teeth over to the care of Dr. John. And he numbed me up. I mean, he numbed me up so much I couldn't even blink my eyes, you know. And then one after another, they chiseled off the caps. Ka-chink, ka-chink, ka-chink. And it smelled like a sewer, man. Oh, it was gross. Blood flying everywhere, picking out what's left of the teeth. Nice teeth. NA teeth. I got me some NA teeth. Oh yeah. Nicest teeth I've ever had, man. I stopped going to the dentist when I was 13 years old. So you can imagine what my choppers look like. Got me a grill now. Anyhow, I survived that without pain medicine. When I was 5 years clean, because of Narcotics Anonymous, I was able to surrender the longest addiction of my life, cigarettes. Thank you, NA. Thank you, NA, for giving me the hope that I could put them down, man, because I used to smoke 2.5 packs of Cool Filter Kings a day. Pneumonia, bronchitis, hospital, it didn't matter. I'm getting mine. Non-smoking restaurants, nah, that's for somebody else. And when I was 5 years clean, or right before, about 6 months before, man, I'm wheezing. Recovery is good. You know, in those days you could smoke in the meetings, you know, I'd be speaking and shit be flying out of my mouth. Wow, what was that? Oh, sorry, lady, I didn't mean that. And these brown things come flying out, phlegm related. And finally, my father one day, who used to smoke corn silk when he was 12 years old in West Virginia, I called him up because he had quit smoking years ago. I said, Dad, I've been smoking since I'm 9 years old. These things are killing me. I said, here I dodged the biggest bullet of my life, heroin addiction, and I'm in the rooms of NA killing myself, one puff at a time. And my dad said, ah, Ronnie, it's easy to quit smoking. I said, really, Dad? He goes, sure. He goes, once you make up your mind that you don't want to smoke anymore, you're going to be amazed how easy it is not to smoke. The hard part is making up your mind. And you know, that's been the same thing for me for everything in my life. There is no pain in change. The pain is in the resistance to change. Newcomers, let us help you change your life. Let us help you. Talk to us. Tell us what's going on inside you. When your head starts telling you you can do one more, tell us in the meeting it's telling you that. We're going to love you through it. We're going to love you until you can love yourself. And then as time goes on, you're going to be able to love somebody else. And that's how this whole thing works. I want to share something about step 6 and step 7. What I learned about defects of character, once I open a door to a defect, I can never lock it. Just like being an addict. I'll be an addict till the day I die. My hope is one day at a time, I'll recover and not use drugs, but I'll always be an addict. And one of the things they have in San Diego is all these Indian gaming centers. And I will not walk into one of those once, because I don't trust myself. And I've learned from other defects that once I open the door, I can't lock it. In step 9, you know, we make amends. I don't know about you guys, but I just finished my 9th step in the step working guide. And one of the humbling things that was very evident to me, after 25 years clean, I realized that under the right set of circumstances, I am capable of doing everything I did using clean. You know, I'm still a thief. Straight up in my mind, I'm a thief. I don't steal today, but I'm a thief. I think like a thief. When I was 9 years clean, I remember being on the area service committee, sponsoring 14 guys, going to meetings, working the steps, and being in the grocery market, going down the aisle with $150 worth of groceries, and I'm looking at the prices and the head starts. Man, they are ripping you off. You're just a straight up chump. Look at the prices, man. You didn't get clean to pay these kind of prices. You're a chump. And at 9 years clean, I'm thinking, you know what? I'm going to even the score. And I see these razor blades, and I'm stealing razor blades. How humbling is that? And then one day I realize, you know what? For $14, You're out of your freaking mind. Call your sponsor. Start talking about this. You know, I went to Canada once. You know, we talk about getting the wreckage of our past redone, right? You know, they wanted me to speak in Canada. So they thought, well, you know, I was there in 1991. I flew into Canada. I spoke in Calgary. It was a good time. Came back, no problems. Now they want me to drive up. So they said, look, we're in Castlegar, Canada. It's above Washington. It's a very little place. We want you to come up and be a part of the convention. We'll pay for your airfare. A bunch of NA people will pick you up at the airport. You'll have a beautiful drive up the American River, and you'll come to the convention. I said, okay. So I go to Spokane. All these NA people pick me up. We go driving up the American River. It's a beautiful ride. We get to the Canadian border. There's this little, like, small customs place with one guy in it. We pull up. The guy who's driving is all excited. Oh, this is Ronnie G. He's our main speaker. We're going to this NA conference. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And the custom guy goes, oh, that's great. He goes, you ever been convicted of a felony? And here I am, 16 years clean, and my head is screaming, tell him no! Tell him no! Tell him no! I want to go into Canada. He goes, Mr. Gonzalez, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Yeah. He goes, well, can you pull over here? Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but in Canada, they have a law that if you've been convicted of two or more felonies, they don't want you in Canada. So here I am sitting at the border. He's going in the computer. He's pulling up all this stuff, and I can't go into Canada. And so finally, after about 45 minutes, he goes, well, you know, if you pay us $325, we'll let you in Canada for 2 days. And I'm like, well, I don't want to speak that bad, you know. I mean, $325, I'm on a fixed income, you know. So the guy driving calls the convention committee, right? And he tells them what's happening. They drove all the way down to the border and paid $325 to get me in the country. And then all weekend, I'm walking around with my head down because everybody, yeah, that's the guy right there. $325, this guy right here, yeah, him. You know, and I got to speak Saturday night. So it's a really smart thing not to put names on who the main speakers are because they may not show up. So that's very wise. Anyhow, what I learned through that is that I'm one bad decision away from jails, institutions, and death. One, they don't care how many people I've sponsored. They don't give a crap how many NA meetings I've attended, how many conventions I've spoken at. They don't care. All I gotta do is make one bad decision and my whole past is in front of me. It's over. You know, our 11th step says that we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. My home group is a Monday night 11-step meeting in San Diego, California. If you're ever out there, come join us. It's a wonderful, focused NA meeting. And one of the things I have to say about this convention committee that I was really impressed with is when they called me up, they interviewed me. That's never, ever happened before. So, do you have a home group? Yes. I'm the secretary of my home group. Okay, do you have a sponsor? Yes, I'm going to see him Wednesday. Are you working any steps? Yes, I'm working in the... They went through this whole thing. And the last thing they asked me, is there anything you would like to tell the convention committee? And what I told them was, yeah, keep up the good work. That was awesome. That's what we should be doing in Narcotics Anonymous. Bringing people in to carry a message that are living the NA way of life. You know, our 12 step says that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to addicts and we practice these principles in all our affairs. And tonight what I'm doing here is trying to carry a message of hope and recovery in the hope that God will use something that I say to help just one person. And I've done a lot of service. You know, I've done H&I for over 24 years in San Diego. I'm still involved in the jails in San Diego. I'm still on the area, central area, Hospitals and Institutions Committee. You know, it's a passion of mine. I sell literature on Tuesdays for the region at the RSO. We have a regional service office where we have phone lines that I man on a weekly basis where addicts that want to get to meetings call up for information. I've done a lot of service in Narcotics Anonymous, but I never dreamed what it was preparing me for. Because 4 years ago, my brother Ramon came down with pancreatic cancer. And I went back to New Jersey like I do every year in the spring, and he came to pick me up at the airport, and he was yellow. And my brother Raymond suffered from mental illness. He had been paranoid schizophrenic for over 17 years. He was on Social Security. We helped him out. We got him a little apartment. He lived about a mile and a half from my mom in New Jersey, and he used to take her everywhere. He was the angel of the family, even though he was very sick. He was afraid of people. And I looked at him. I said, Raymond, man, you got hepatitis. He goes, yeah, I know, Ronnie. I said, Raymond, have you been to the doctor? He says, no, I'm not going to go to the doctor. I said, Raymond, you have to go to the doctor. And while I was in New Jersey, we talked him into going into the hospital, and he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And the doctor said he had 3 to 6 months to live. And Raymond was taking me back to the airport after a month of being in New Jersey. And Raymond and I kissed, like we always kissed, as brothers goodbye. And he said, Ronnie, I can't go into a hospital. Will you help me die at home? And I looked him in the eyes. And everything inside of me wanted to say, no, I can't do this, Ray. You're my brother. I've never seen anybody die. I don't know how to take care of someone who's dying. I don't have that kind of courage, Raymond. But what came out of my mouth was, because of Narcotics Anonymous, Raymond, I'll do whatever you want me to do. You call me, and I'll be here for you, Ray. And three months later, Raymond, we had been talking on the phone on a weekly basis. And Raymond called me up and said, Ronnie, I can't do this anymore. You have to come out and help me. Hospice wants you to come out and help me. I said, all right, Raymond. And I got on a plane and I flew back to New Jersey. And NA members in New Jersey gave me an air mattress because my brother lived in a little 200 square foot apartment in Linden, New Jersey. It was a studio apartment. And his couch was his bed. And I had nowhere to sleep staying with him. And so my friends in NA gave me an air mattress that I blew up and put on the kitchen floor. And one day at a time, I started to live with Raymond. And he honored me with the gift of giving him his last shower on earth. And he honored me with the gift of helping him out and walking through my fears. Because, you know, my brother trusted Narcotics Anonymous. My brother had seen the miracle that Narcotics Anonymous had done in my life. He didn't ask my mother. He didn't ask my brother Robert, who's a wonderful father of three, never been high a day in his life, church-going guy. He didn't ask my sister, who's a wonderful, God-loving woman. He asked me because he saw what NA did in my life. He trusted me because of Narcotics Anonymous. And a week later, another NA member flew out to New Jersey, my wife, because Raymond was a big man. He was over 300 pounds, and we had to get a hospital bed and put it in his living room. And we had to change him. And we had to change sheets and diapers and move him. And I had to give him medications. And every 3 to 4 hours, I was giving him morphine sulfate. And I'm a junkie, man. And every time I'd go to that bottle to pull out a morphine sulfate, I would pray, please, dear God, don't let me put this in my mouth. I'm 3 feet away from the end of my life. And one day at a time, my wife and me took care of Raymond. And the day he took his last breath, my mother, my brother Robert, my sister Diane, my wife Michelle, and I were there to kiss him, to hold him, to tell him that everything was going to be okay. And we watched my brother leave this world. And I got that gift of doing that through the program of Narcotics Anonymous. Everything of value in this addict's life is because I found a way to stay clean and recover from the disease of addiction in the program of Narcotics Anonymous. There's two people sitting in this room tonight, my friend CJ and my friend Annette, who have been taking care of my mom for the last year and a half, taking her to doctors, bringing her food, cleaning her house. My mother's 86 years old. She lives in the same house I grew up in Rosedale, New Jersey. And NA members are helping her not to go into a home. That's what NA is doing for this addict. You know, Wednesday, another NA member came over at my mother's house and fixed her toilet. The love of Narcotics Anonymous. Everything of value in my life is because of this program. You know, I'm going to end with this. We say that this is a spiritual program of recovery. And there was two guys in San Diego that were really spiritual. Tony and Al. These guys used drugs together. These guys went to prison together. These guys got clean together. These guys used to go to NA meetings together. These guys got work at the same factory together. These guys dated and married sisters together. They were inseparable. You'd see them on H&I panels together. Anywhere you saw Tony, you saw Al. And one night after a meeting, Tony says to Al, "Hey, Al, you think there's a Narcotics Anonymous in heaven?" And Tony says, "Well, I don't know, man. Why don't we make a blood brother pact, and whoever dies first, let's promise we'll come back and tell the other one whether or not there's an NA meeting in heaven." He says, "All right, great." So they cut their wrists, you know, and they do the blood brother thing, and they make this pact. And a week later, Tony is walking across Broad Street in San Diego, and bam, gets run over by a bus. Ah, terrible. NA is mourning. Big NA memorial. Poor Tony's gone. Everybody's sad. We're crushed. About a week and a half later, Al's laying in bed. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. All of a sudden, this white light appears on the ceiling. Ooh. Ooh. Al goes, "Tony, is that you?" Tony goes, "Al, it's me, and I came back from heaven." He goes, "Oh my God, that's fantastic! Did you come to tell me if there's an NA meeting in heaven?" Tony goes, "Well, Al, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news." Al goes, "Well, tell me what the good news is, Tony." He goes, "Well, in heaven, there's a giant Narcotics Anonymous speaker meeting and I'm the secretary." And Al goes, "That's fantastic. What's the bad news?" "You're my speaker on Sunday." Thank you, Marilyn. Thank you, Marilyn, for letting me come and be a part of this convention. I believe in my heart that together we can do something none of us can do alone. Thank you, Narcotics Anonymous.